May is a wonderful time of year. Well, at least it is for me. The spring air is warm, the medical students have graduated, and the residents are all on autopilot waiting for their real jobs, which means it's time for me to go on vacation. But does that mean we cancel AZMcast? No, siree. Instead, I phone it in by ripping off one of this year's senior residents' grand rounds. We had some excellent presentations, but I am fortunate that Dr. Taylor Shekel was willing to let us use her grand rounds on dealing with conflict for this month's episode. This is a subject we face on a daily, no, hourly, no, minutely, is that a word? Anyway, we deal with it a lot, and we get really good at it, or at least we think we do. Dr. Shekel does an excellent job of describing conflict management strategies and applying them to our job in the emergency department. This is not a heavily evidence-based talk, but she manages to find some great references, which we will point out to you with the bell dings. And sometimes you need to focus on those artful aspects of our job that can't be defined with kappas and confidence intervals. So, find your happy place and enjoy Dr. Shekel's superb talk on managing conflict in the ED.
Thanks for coming to my grand rounds. We're talking about conflict resolution and communication skills in the emergency department. I'd like to start by saying that I have no disclosures. I have not learned anything about this until the last month or so, outside of maybe something in high school health class that I vaguely remember. The level of evidence is pretty low. It's a lot of expert opinions, and there certainly is a lot of interesting research in behavioral health, behavioral sciences in this area, but certainly no Cochrane reviews or RCTs kind of dealing with like the daily negotiations and conflicts we encounter in our lives. I'm going to intersperse my slides with some ways that I find helpful to deal with conflicts when they become overwhelming and stressful, including some quotes, meditation, fun things I enjoy doing, pictures of my dogs. So the title might seem a little bit strange, so I'm first going to explain the 18th camel. I tried explaining this to Allie's 7-year-old son last night. He was confused. So there's a guy that dies and he leaves his sons his 17 camels. And to his oldest son, he leaves half of his camels. To his second oldest son, he leaves a third of his camels. And to his youngest son, he leaves a ninth of the camels. So, you know, as you can imagine, 17 doesn't divide evenly in halves, thirds, or ninths. So they have a conflict. And they go to this old lady in the town and ask, "What should we do?" And she says, "I don't know how to resolve your argument, but you can have my camel." So now they go home and they have 18 camels. So 18 divides in half. The first son gets his 9 camels. 18 divides in thirds. So the second oldest son gets his 6 camels. And 18 divides in ninths. So the youngest son gets 2 camels. 8 plus 6 plus 2 is 17. They have 1 camel left over and they give it back to the old lady. Introduction, I'm going to start off by talking about what is conflict, a little bit of behavioral science background, some resolution models, some tips and techniques, and examples from outside of medicine, mostly from the business world, and then putting everything to use. We'll start off with, this is a verse from the Tao about relativity. We know beauty because there is ugly. We know good because there is evil. Being and not being, having and not having, create each other. Difficult and easy, long and short, high and low, define each other. Just as before and after, follow each other. The wise teach without telling, allow without commanding, have without possessing, care without claiming. And in this way, we harvest eternal importance because we never announce it. So what is conflict? The dictionary tells us that it's a serious disagreement. It's a prolonged armed struggle, maybe an incompatibility between two or more opinions, a condition within a person when you experience clash of opposing wishes or needs. Comes from the Latin of together and to strike, and also striking together in a contest to give us our modern day definition of conflict. You type in conflict to Twitter, which is the first time I've ever used Twitter. A lot of things things come up. President Obama wants to get rid of conflict and coercion. UNICEF wants to eliminate conflict in the lives of children. At Geek Tyrant wants to explain the conflict between Captain America and Iron Man. And certainly football is a conflict. At Kugmom says I'm having an internal conflict, if I should stay after school or not, I don't know. Outside of kind of our dictionary definitions and layman's terms, conflict is definitely inevitable and unavoidable. However, the negative effects of conflict and kind of how we choose to deal with conflict and allow it to escalate out of control is avoidable. Conflict has effects on our relationships, our work and social environment. It triggers really strong emotions. Conflict can create learning opportunities and opportunities to generate positive outcomes, creativity, and it's not essentially good or bad. So some examples of when conflict is good is when it opens up issues of importance, helps build cohesiveness, examines and reassesses procedures or actions, increases individual involvement, and generally just has a positive effect on a group or relationship. When conflict is bad, it diverts energy away from important issues, has negative effects on the group or their relationship, destroys morale. And actually, some of the people that I found that did a lot of research in this area in the field of social sciences are Peterson and Bayfar, and in 2003 they studied different groups of people working together in office environments, healthcare environments, and they found that a moderate level of conflict across tasks within a group tends to increase the productivity of the group in general, whereas conflict among personalities in a group tends to lower the productivity of the group. So where does conflict come from? I think simply it can be defined as a mismatch of something. Expectations, fear, attachment, differing knowledge, stress, incompatible values or goals. Basically occurs whenever people disagree over their values, motivations, perceptions, or ideas. And when a conflict triggers strong emotion, a deep personal need is often at the core of the problem. One of the definitions I really liked was, a conflict is an express struggle between at least two interdependent parties who perceive incompatible goals, scarce resources, and interference from the other party in achieving their goal. So conflict is definitely going to happen. It occurs at all levels of interactions. It's a critical event in the course of a relationship. And whether the relationship is healthy or not, whether it's a personal relationship or a working relationship, really depends not on the number of conflict, but how the conflicts are resolved. Social research has shown that we tend to respond to conflicts based on our perception of the situation and not necessarily an objective review of the facts. And our perceptions are influenced by our life experiences, cultures, values, and beliefs. And conflict tends to get out of hand either from a loss of communication or overpowering emotions. And this kind of theme of emotions and communication we're going to talk about later.
Kara, that sounds like my divorce.
Yeah.
Pretty exactly.
I hope I did send the email out yesterday. This looks like your divorce? Asking people to keep in mind their most recent conflict. So another definition I really liked was that conflict arises from a clash of perceptions, goals, or values in an area where people care about the outcome. I'd say that represents our job. We all care about the outcome of our patients. And often conflict has a lot of underlying factors that are unrealized by the people involved. So this is an example from a talk about conflict in healthcare where a physician is consistently saying, I deserve more money. And so on the surface, what do you think this conflict is about? Resources, like the wolves struggling over the limited amount of money.
Status.
But underlying that statement of I deserve money are all these other unrealized factors. History, I've never been adequately compensated. Relationships, the chief has never respected me. Emotions, I feel unvalued. Structures, the public healthcare system's at fault. Needs, I have needs and responsibilities to provide for myself and my family. And communication issues, the chief never talks to me directly. They only send emails. Which I'm sure, you've all been feeling in the past. Another quote from the Tao, verse 26, inner strength is the master of all frivolities. Tranquility is the master of all agitated emotions. Those who succumb to frivolities have lost their inner strength. Those who succumb to agitated emotions have lost their tranquility. The wise cultivate inner strength and tranquility. So what is conflict resolution? These are my dogs at Christmas, fighting over their Christmas present. Conflict resolution is otherwise known as reconciliation. It's the process of facilitating and resolving a conflict. And conflict management takes it one step further and describes the opportunity to improve situations or strengthen relationships within a group of people that you're involved with. We'll see an example here.
All right, Kevin, you are accused of making sexually suggestive remarks to Angela that made her feel uncomfortable. Solution. Angela, you are to make sexually suggestive remarks to Kevin that will make him uncomfortable.
I accept your decision.
So Michael is managing conflict there. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about some behavioral models for how we deal with conflict. The first is this dual concern model. So it basically says that your personal method for dealing with conflict is based on a balance of assertiveness, or concern for yourself, and empathy, or concern for others. And this leads to five major styles. Each is, you know, not necessarily good or bad, but used in different situations. And really asks the question, are you more concerned with improving and maintaining relationships, or about yourself and your ability to win? So the people who came up with this are Thomas and Kilman, and kind of as this visual representation of these five different styles and the balance of assertiveness and cooperativeness. So the first one, competing, this is my way or the highway, it's highly aggressive. It's all about me and not about the other people involved. It has some advantages if you need quick action or if you're in a situation that may be dangerous if you take the time to try for cooperation. The disadvantages obviously are that the issues are usually unresolved. You're not really gaining any input from the other parties. You lose the opportunity for creativity, and you may get this kind of phenomenon of silent acquiescence and later sabotage of your plan. It creates an environment of fear, lack of transparency, reduced learning, and you're unlikely to get any feedback about your decision. Avoiding is head in the sand, not really going to deal with the problem at all. It doesn't satisfy anyone involved in the situation. It's kind of a lose-lose situation. And it can have an advantage if the issue is not important or if you need to delay time until some other things are resolved, until you can control the situation. And obvious disadvantages, there's a very low level of input. It's issues will fester, frustration is high, and communications break down. Accommodating, kind of over on the far right bottom, is whatever you want. Satisfy other people, not yourself. And you may want to use this in a situation where you want to show that you're reasonable, maybe create goodwill. And a disadvantage is that your input is obviously ignored. It restricts your level of influence and leads to resentment. So compromising, a kind of 50-50 mix of assertiveness and cooperativeness, is splitting the difference. Moderately satisfies everyone's concerns, but the issues are usually not fully resolved. This is something important to use when maybe for a temporary solution. You lose some creativeness and collaboration. It can be indecisive. And then the ideal situation is the top right, collaboration. So everyone gets what they want. It's a work together situation, satisfies all parties equally. You want to use this as often as possible. It creates durable outcomes, supports discussion of issues and equal distribution of work, creates learning and positive environments, and focuses on the interests that underlie the conflict. It's also called an interest-based approach. And the downsides, obviously, that can take time and be frustrating for people that want an immediate decision. And so kind of very similar to this is styles on conflict management. And obviously the best is going to be the team management, where you have high production, high satisfaction of all of the people involved. Everyone's working together. You're not smoothing over situations. You're not ignoring situations. And it's kind of like an overall win-win style of management. And this is also part of where my title came from. So the people who describe this call that team management approach the fifth achievement. It's from a Journal of Applied Behavioral Science in 1970. So it's an example of the win-win-win.
Okay,
Well, before we get started, you should know that there are 5 different styles of conflict. My Shaolin temper style defeats your monkey style.
Can we go? I have a lot of work to do.
Nope, this is important. Okay, the first style is lose-lose.
What's the next one?
Just hold on, please. Okay, if we do lose-lose, neither of you gets what you want. Do you understand? You would both lose. Now I need to ask you, do you want to pursue a lose-lose negotiation?
Can we just skip to whatever number 5 is, win-win or whatever?
Win-win is number 4, and number 5 is win-win-win. The important difference here is with win-win-win, we all win. Me too. I win for having successfully mediated a conflict at work.
Now let's talk about preparing for resolution. So this is the start line of a 100-mile mountain bike race I did this summer in Bend. It started super early, did a lot of preparation. So one of the first things you need to think about is who should be at the table. So who are the people directly involved in the conflict? And then I think it's important to realize who are the people that are maybe affected by it, who are the people that may have an interest in the conflict. I think an example are when we all get together and talk about maybe nursing issues, and without kind of going directly to maybe the ED ops meeting and passing those along to the nursing managers, they may never be involved in what we perceive as a conflict. Kind of discovering what are the main issues, and these may not be obvious. Like the previous slides, you know, it may seem on the surface like you're arguing about money, but a lot of other things in terms of history and communication may be underlying the issues, and this is a good time to kind of apply your differential diagnosis building skills and kind of come up with what else might be going on and rank it in order of importance. What are the origin of the various issues? This can be things like rules, values, interests, ethical issues, goals of care, and you know, maybe deciding if you feel like you're going to need a third-party mediator, because some of these origin issues are really emotionally charged. And then I think it's really important to consider various personality types. We all have different communication styles, styles of giving and receiving feedback, styles of learning, and trying to like engage someone in a meaningful discussion without realizing that they may receive and digest information differently from you, unsuccessful. And then again, our common themes of communication skills and emotions. So, does anyone know what this is? Have you guys taken Myers-Briggs ever? Yeah, we had to do it in medical school, and I can't remember what my combination of letters were, but I kind of feel like I was like trying to be a certain way when I took it. Anyways, a lot of different questions, and what it really gets down to is trying to figure out how you focus your attention, how you gather information, how you make decisions, and how you deal with the outer world. And kind of in your combination of these 8 letters can actually predict how you lead, how you work in a group, how you perceive and resolve conflict, and how you teach and learn. Does anyone remember what your type is? Anyone? What are you, Dang?
INTJ.
So there is some information about like what personality types may go into certain specialties. This chart wasn't complete. INTJ is not on there. But emergency medicine is also not on here, and I think that we could probably fit into a lot of different personality types as anyone at work has encountered. But let's see. You can determine your Harry Potter character. So where is INTJ? Yep, your Dang is Voldemort. All right, so let's talk about some steps towards resolution. Number 1, staying calm. So when we are angry or under stress, it pretty much makes us stupid. We can't listen, we can't perceive nonverbal feedback, we can't communicate effectively, and we listen not really even to what's being said, but in order to argue back. Sometimes I find when I'm doing something really fun that I enjoy, like this is on top of Mount Bachelor, looking out and kind of taking a mental picture, and I think next time there's 20 red X's on the board, I'm just going to like go here for a minute and before I react. Other things. So listening to understand, like I said before, instead of listening to react. We'll talk about that more in a little bit. Staying positive, stating your case tactfully, attacking the problem, not the person, avoiding accusations and blame, focusing on the future, asking the right kind of questions, picking your battles, linking offers, being creative, confident, and celebrating agreement. I was looking at this talk with Allie last night, and she's like, this sounds like parenting. So I want to talk about the role of emotion and self-awareness first. So the emotional weight of decision-making is not something that we often share or discuss. We don't talk about how hard it is to make decisions in M&M or in CPI or in our medical decision-making. But I think realizing that this is a huge factor in not only creating, but our reactions to conflict is really important. And the weight of feeling like you know what's ethically appropriate to do, but you cannot, is something that can really affect your performance and your ability to enjoy your job. Self-awareness is recognition of your personality, of our strengths and weaknesses, our likes and dislikes. Truly listening to other people needs to start with listening to ourselves. It's a prerequisite for effective communication. If you think about it, you know, we have all this like noise and distraction. Our job is all about multitasking. Our minds are almost never silent. But if you really want to listen to another person, you kind of have to start with listening to yourself, paying attention to your own mind and quieting your mind. Clearing your mind and preparing yourself to let go of your emotions and fears about a situation and try to observe it objectively. This kind of leads to this tool on the right. It's called the Johari Window Tool, and it's kind of a neat pictorial representation of self-growth, kind of moving from the known self, which is what you know about yourself and other people's know about you, into the unknown self. And you do this through feedback, and feedback helps you gain access to your hidden self, which is the things that other people may know about you but you're unaware of. And with self-disclosure, you allow other people to see parts of yourself that you usually keep hidden. And then that green little box kind of keeps growing as you go on in your life and your career. So I want to talk a little bit about giving feedback then. So is an essential part of learning, growing, and gaining self-awareness, as we saw before. Feedback is essential for good communication, and you can't resolve a conflict without feedback. Feedback should be seen as a gift, as an opportunity to expand your known self. And there's definitely an art to giving feedback. We offer feedback because we care about the success of the individual and the team. And these are some specific tips. So feedback should be timely and appropriate. If there's a specific issue that you want to give feedback on, doing it as soon as possible after using specific examples can be helpful. Unless emotions are supercharged, then you can wait. Feedback should be appropriate. Appropriate, I think, to the level of maybe training of the person. Obviously appropriate in the fact that, you know, feedback should be about a behavior, not about a personality trait. People can't change who they are. And also appropriate in that feedback should be given in private and in person. Feedback should be realistic and actionable. Like I said, it should be about a behavior or an action that can be changed and planned for. If feedback should be specific, it should be as clear as possible. Like I said, using specific examples if possible. And I think it's important when you're giving feedback to set the stage and remind a person that you're giving feedback about a behavior and not about them. Don't be vague and don't pass along vague feedback from other people. Use direct quotes and don't give your feedback in a sandwich is what this is called, where you're trying to convey an important message, but you couch it with some fluffy stuff on either side. I think your message will get lost if you try to do this. And after you provide your feedback, resist the temptation to go into a but sentence. I'm really frustrated with XYZ is the message you want to send. And it's okay to have silence at the end. So the SBI model just kind of reminds us to set the situation using specific examples, describe a behavior, and then describing its impact it had on you, on the people around you, and then make a plan for change. Oh, and I skipped over it, non-judgmental. So feedback should definitely be about, like I said, about the behavior. And one way to stay non-judgmental is using something like I statements instead of saying, like, you are always doing XYZ, which can be really accusatory. It can lead to, like, moral and judgment statements, saying rather, I feel upset when you do this. Can keep it focused on the issue and the behavior. So receiving feedback is also a skill. I think it's important to keep in mind that hopefully the person that's giving you feedback is doing it for the right intentions, and you have to assume that they are trying to help you grow and help you become a better individual and a better part of the team. So be open-minded, listen attentively, listen not only to what's being said, but listen to your own emotions and your reactions. I think none of us want to feel like we're doing a bad job, and that might be the initial reaction when someone starts giving you feedback, is like, feeling attacked, and you know, kind of resist the urge to fight back and explain yourself, and so that you can fully listen to what's being said. But repeating back what you heard to make sure you have the right message, asking for specifics, including what you're doing well, is appropriate. Sharing your own views on the situation, and then jointly planning for ways to improve, setting up a time to check back in, and expressing appreciation. And it's definitely a two-way street. I think once you give feedback, asking, you know, how do you think this is appropriate? Do you think I have an appropriate view of the situation? Can be helpful. So in this kind of realm of self-discovery, there's a really interesting article I read called Emergency Medicine as a Martial Art, where they compare lifelong training of, I guess, ninjas to emergency medicine. So this quote comes from there. The rigorous training is not an end in itself. It is designed to enable the student to experience aspects of himself that usually remain hidden, or that he was unable to see because his prevailing idea of himself obscured his views. He is often pushed beyond the limits he would have chosen for himself, finding that he can go far past the point of apparent physical endurance. He learns about his capabilities under this and related kinds of pressures. Our practice, therefore, becomes a mirror, a direct perception of who we really are and not the idealized image of whom we wish to be. In this honest, uninhibited observation, there is the beginning of the understanding of self. So we talked about emotions, so I want to talk about the role of good communication. So a couple important communication skills: listening fully to what's being said without planning your response. I think this is really hard for some of us. We want to, you know, respond and explain our actions. We want to, when patients are talking to us, you know, we are thinking about what we're going to say next, like, oh, what does that mean? That could go over here, and you kind of lose track of what's actually being said. Listening for insights into what's important to the speaker, what values and beliefs are being expressed, what part of the conversation, like what specific topics seem to be making the person especially emotional, what's important to them. Checking to make sure you're getting the right message, pausing to think about what else you might need to know, asking clarifying questions, and responding. So listening to understand was a specific skill kind of described by this guy, William Urey. He's a Harvard business professor. He wrote a really interesting book called Getting to Yes, all about negotiation and interest-based conflict resolution. And he talks about these being specific new skills that we need to learn. And these are, this is my dog and Nicola's dog, all learning to listen. And it does not come naturally. So, you know, communication is both speaking, verbal skills, nonverbal skills, feedback skills, but I think listening skills are something that we'd often overlook. And if you think about it, negotiation is trying to change someone else's mind. But if you don't truly understand their mind frame and where they're coming from, i.e. you haven't listened to them fully, it's going to be pretty hard to change their mind. Listening builds rapport. Listening to someone fully makes it more likely that they will listen to you. And, you know, if you think about it, when someone else is speaking, not just a patient, but we're usually gathering our arguments, thinking up a rebuttal, we don't usually hear what the other person is really saying. And as soon as there's a pause, we jump in to make points that we've been planning in our head. And I think this is like the perfect example is maybe a presidential debate or a talk news show where everyone is just like saying something, but they don't really correlate to what the other person is saying or what question is being asked, because people just so strongly want to make their point that they blurt it out at any inappropriate time, and no one is actually listening or responding to each other. So, you know, genuine listening includes focusing on the other person, putting yourself in their shoes, listening from their frame of reference, listening to what's being said and not being said, the ideas of behind the words, the feelings, needs, and emotions. So we talked about listening skills. Now we'll talk about some speaking skills. So there are four basic ways that we can speak. So passive speakers, these are people that give self-limiting or qualifying expressions without actually stating their position or need. So an example of this may be if a nurse or another resident says, "Can you see this patient?" And the response is, "After I sew up this slack and do all these discharges and pick up this other person and go to the bathroom." So there's not actually like a need or a position in that statement. So a better, you know, response may be, "No, I am feeling really overwhelmed and I'll try to later." Aggressive speakers, these are people that definitely clearly state their intentions but do so by violating rights of others. And then the combination of passive-aggressive speaking is speaking in a passive way but building hostility and often changing your position after the conflict. So then our kind of ideal mode of speaking, in a, especially a conflict situation, is being assertive. So being assertive is expressing your thoughts and feelings, asking for what one wants in an appropriate way, presenting a message without being pushy or passive. You're stating your position without violating the rights of others. And this is actually considered an adult ego stage, where you're okay with yourself, you're okay with the people around you, and you're just having an adult conversation and communication of needs. Ways to do this are by setting a clear objective, determining how you're going to meet that objective in a win-win situation, developing an assertive phrase that you're going to use in this situation, which I think is helpful to maybe have ahead of time, and implementing your plan persistently. Some ways you can do this are by using I statements. So this is something I do remember learning in high school health, that instead of saying, "You're always late for dinner," saying, "I feel unvalued when you're late for dinner." It's much less accusatory. I think it's similar to asking children to use their words. But it can be helpful. And here's an example from a college poster promoting I statements to focus on your feelings. "I feel uncomfortable when you grind on other people without asking first." This is from Wesleyan College. They're very liberal there, I guess. All right, so I just wanted to talk about a couple kind of approaches, not just based on communication or emotion, but kind of putting everything together. So I really like this approach. It's not necessarily for like a huge conflict that you need, you know, mediation for, but kind of your everyday interactions with people. So A stands for assuming the positive. If you're having a difficult interaction with someone, kind of assuming that they're a good person, that they're not trying to cause you grief and pain, that if they're difficult to deal with, that maybe they have something else going on in their life and that it's about them and not you. This is something they talk to us about in chief training. That's if you're having a specific issue with someone, the first thing you should do is ask them if they're okay. V stands for validating the unknown. So if you're unable to assume the positive about people, maybe you should ask and validate your negative assumptions. Find out what's going on. Seek to understand the behavior before reacting to it. If you cannot do that, ignoring the unchangeable can sometimes be helpful. Like I said before, with feedback, you want to give feedback about a behavior that's changeable. But if it's someone's personality or specific quirks that you can't deal with, then maybe it's an appropriate situation to use avoidance. Let the issue go. Pick your battle. If you can't do any of that, then do something productive. I recommend axe throwing on skis. It's a great stress reliever, but also includes debriefing, discussing, and you know, if you don't do this, then your feelings are going to build up and lead to anger and resentment and being jaded. Kind of another comprehensive approach is something that I learned also on this trip with a National Outdoor Leadership School in high school. I was 17. We went backpacking in the Wind River Wilderness for a month, and a bunch of teenagers in the wilderness, there was a lot of conflict, and the way that they taught us to deal it was vomp your problems. So ventilate, just expressing your side of the issue, own your own words and actions that may have contributed, empathize with the other side and make a plan. So an example I thought of was maybe if you're getting multiple frustrating calls from a nurse about pain medication for a patient, maybe, saying, I'm feeling really frustrated with all of these calls. I understand that I haven't actually answered all the calls, and that's probably frustrating to you. I know this patient's probably annoying the heck out of you. Let's order Q 30-minute Dilaudid and stuff. So that would hit all those points. I couldn't remember what this was called, and I found the journal that I'd written it down in, and my 17-year-old self also wrote down this list of aspects of a good leader, and I thought it was appropriate to include because, we all find ourselves in designated leadership roles, whether we like it or not, where we're facilitating groups and helping to resolve conflict among others, and we also are all self-leaders. We are all involved in a, highly functioning work environment where we are exhibiting self-control, saying how we feel, acting like professionals and adults. And these are some aspects that I thought were important. I think tolerance of adversity, being a good communicator, things we talked about. I also found in there, I wrote down, things that can kill you. Too much heat, too much cold, fall from a high place. That's what I learned. That is a quote from Lao Tzu. I have just three things to teach. Simplicity, patience, compassion. These are your greatest treasures. Patient with both friend and enemies, you accord the way things are. All right, and then quickly, after all of those skills fail you, some options for resolution in conflicts that seem beyond your ability to navigate yourself. Obviously, negotiation, you've probably already tried that step if you're trying to escalate. An ombudsperson is a word that I always thought is really strange, but it's an independent, confidential, designated neutral person who works in an impartial and informal way to kind of guide you on the path to resolution, and Dr. Rappaport is our ombudsperson. I would definitely talk to him about my problems. He's very nice. Other options are organizational assistance points like human resources and ethics board. A process facilitator is a little bit more formal than an ombudsperson. They kind of stay with the group the whole way through the conflict, but they don't decide a decision, and they're still part of an organization. A mixed panel of stakeholders is basically getting everybody involved in voting. Mediation, this is a huge profession. I didn't really realize. So this is an outside group usually or a person that's hired to come in and help work the conflict out. And then arbitrator is similar to that, except they actually decide the decision after listening to everyone's side, and then obviously court. So I wanted to talk about a couple of real-world examples kind of from the business world. So I emailed out my idea for this talk to my dad, who's owned a business for a long time, and some of his friends who all own various businesses and kind of look like mafia members if you see them in golfing pictures. But his friend Ron D'Annunzio owns multiple restaurants in western Pennsylvania. He has 250 employees, and his advice was, be patient and listen carefully before reacting. Sometimes the best response is no response. Stay focused on your customer and don't let your personal feelings interfere. And then I also talked with my dad. I actually decided to do this talk one time last year after a really frustrating shift at South Campus where I felt like every personal interaction I had blew up in my face. And I remember calling him and saying, how have you had a company for 37 years? How do you manage people all day long? So he started his company October 2nd, so just coming up on 37 years. And they make parts for coal-burning power plants. So they have engineers, project managers, welders, sales folks. And if you don't know how a coal-burning power plant works, basically coal goes in and you burn it and water goes through it and makes steam that runs a turbine and a generator. His advice was, in business, conflict is the last thing you want to deal with. Resolving conflicts is counterproductive to the goals of the organization and wastes valuable time. And he identified three types of conflict. Conflict when policies and procedures are not followed. So he said if a policy is not being followed, try to figure out why. Get input from everyone. See if it needs to be rewritten or if it needs to be more strongly enforced. Conflicts between employees and management. Not every employee is a good employee and not every manager is a good manager. But mutual respect and open communication is always a better strategy than dictatorial styles. Most employees want to do a good job, but if they're disrespected and taken for granted, they can turn into a problem. Be listening, be caring, and listen. And then I thought this was interesting. You know, most managers are in their position not because they're well-trained in management, but because they're good at their job. And the hope is they will be good at their new job once they're promoted. And then obviously conflicts between employees, kind of recognizing any situations of fear or intimidation and trying to mitigate that. And overall, trying to get to the real truth of the issue. Get opinions from as many people as possible, weigh the evidence, sit back and observe, and be patient in your decision making. All right, so why is this relevant to us? It's definitely part of our job. Sometimes it feels like we're just managing a bunch of children. And I'm sure it feels that way to nurses about us and, you know, attendings, and we feel that way about our patients, and it's just kind of this huge, you know, area of our training that I think we kind of learn on the job. So we're leaders and managers. We deal with conflict all day long. There are really complex dynamics and interdependencies of various relationships in healthcare. But if you recognize conflict and learn to deal with it swiftly and appropriately, it can improve your personal and work relationship, decrease your stress, and it does actually have measurable conflicts. Obviously, direct costs like litigation and having to hire new people, but indirect costs on your morale, patient safety, emotional costs, creating a culture of fear instead of openness. And then I wanted to talk about some specific factors that I think come into play in healthcare. This is kind of a lot of words, but I wanted to go through these individually. So the complexity of the healthcare system means that misunderstandings and conflict occur at multiple levels at the same time. I think we saw that with the phone, so we like kind of brought it up here, and then it goes up through these various levels, and everyone has a different view and opinion on that. There's a wide disparity of knowledge, power, and control. So I think residents often feel this conflict where they're not sure where they are on the hierarchy in a team, especially something more like with a bigger team, like an ICU or inpatient team. You feel you know, this difference in power, difference in knowledge, and it can lead to significant distress. And even some values and rule-based conflict if you're being asked to violate duty hours, things like that. Individuals that we encounter often have strongly held personal or religious values, unchangeable positions. Physician expectations, I think, leads to conflict. We're expected to be compassionate, respectful, non-judgmental, just this ideal moral character at all times, which is unrealistic. There's a contribution of fear, shame, or blame. Conflict to a healthcare person often means like litigation, lawyers, I need to defend myself, I'm gonna like, you know, sit back and try to do what's best for me. Patients and families often disagree with our challenge our recommended treatment plans, which can be difficult. We feel like we have spent a lot of time learning, and this can really underlie like values-based issues for, you know, extended and prolonged heroic measures, allowing natural death or not, and disagreement with colleagues about treatment decisions may be shared with others rather than the individual involved. There's kind of a culture of open criticism, I think, especially if you've ever been to M&M. And I wanted to share this quote from Dr. Osler. From the day you begin practice, never under any circumstances listen to a tale told to the detriment of a brother practitioner. Never let your tongue say a slighting word of a colleague. I think that can be really hard sometimes. When dealing with conflict, especially ethical conflicts, there are a lot of competing goals. So we obviously want to avoid and resolve the conflict, but we also want to protect ourselves and our decisions, kind of show that we are right, protect our group's integrity and our own integrity, and then patient behavior. I think maybe when I said I was talking about conflict resolution, you all immediately thought about difficult patients. Patient behavior can lead to strong negative emotions that we feel like we're not supposed to have because we're supposed to be this ideal physician. And oftentimes we can release those on our colleagues and on our family members. So I wanted to talk about difficult patients briefly. There's actually a really good chapter in Rosen's, chapter 189. You should read it. I'll try to email it, about dealing with difficult patients. And Michelle Rhodes shared this with me. Ron Walls is one of the authors, and they define a difficult patient as any patient who interferes with the physician's ability to establish a normal patient-physician relationship. And this can be from specific patient factors. It can also be from physician factors, maybe past experiences with this patient or patients like this. It can be from your stress and fatigue, your long hours, your hunger, and then environmental factors. The ED is not a warm, welcoming, you know, wonderful place to deal with difficult people. And then this combination of factors kind of leads to this cycle of impaired relationships where the physician feels kind of negatively towards this patient. And it might be from, because the patient's needy or they have some, you know, maladaptive behavior traits. And then it leads us to feel negatively about the patient, which can make us feel frustrated. And then we have kind of this body language that the patient can perceive. And they feel like, this person doesn't take me seriously. I feel abandoned. I'm going to, like, step it up and say, now it's 10 out of 10. And then we don't like the patient even more. And it leads to this kind of vicious cycle. Things like getting called away for trauma and how busy and interrupted the ED is can contribute. And then, you know, I think the thing to recognize is that this can really lead to burnout, a sense of failure, and also negative effects on the patient. So one of the first steps in this chapter that they recommend in dealing with difficult patients is kind of placing them into these behavioral categories, and kind of by recognizing them as a behavioral presentation may help to kind of distance you and set the patient off in this category a little bit, help you deal with them more objectively. So I thought these were really interesting. I've never heard this, like, described and categorized before. So dependent patient, see if you know anyone like this. They want endless compassion and understanding. The more care they receive, the more needs they have, they're overly grateful. The entitled patients, these are VIPs, they're well-informed, they have endless needs, but they use intimidation, hostility, and threats. They have frequent demands, they need to be seen right away, they need specific and over-the-top testing, they put pressure on you to prescribe them medications and referrals and order tests, and they complain that every need is not being met. The intractable patient, they have insatiable needs for emotional support. They believe nothing will help. They're desperately seeking help despite the failure of all previous medical assistance, multiple ED visits with negative workups. And then the self-destructive patient. They don't seek help. They're repeatedly brought in because of their neglectful behavior. They deny their problems. They often require heroic efforts. And despite that, they keep performing the same behavior. So the chapter in Rosen's outlines a strategy for specific tools to deal with difficult patients. So being supportive and showing empathy can sometimes be really hard, and that may be all that person really wants. But you do have to structure your interview. You have to impose time limits. You can only show empathy to a crazy person for so long before you need to leave the room, and that's okay. Setting limits in general for behavior. Maybe this might be swearing or, you know, being belligerent or running around in the hall. Pointing out impasses, I feel like this can be helpful. You say, okay, you want pain medicine, I don't want to give you pain medicine, how are we going to solve this? And put the burden of solving the issue kind of on the patient. Sharing your reactions, so I think selectively sharing your emotions with the patient can be helpful, saying, I'm really frustrated right now. Redirecting the interview, avoiding really trivial or chronic complaints, kind of bringing it all back to, why are you here today? Taking a time out. Sometimes you just have to leave the room, and that is okay. Using teamwork, making sure everyone is on the same page about discharge planning, medications, why we're doing or not doing tests, and sometimes just asking a colleague to come take a look at the situation because you feel like you can no longer be objective because it's so frustrating. Understanding the patient's agenda. So I think this is really helpful, just asking in a non-judgmental way, why are you here? You know, you're hearing like toe and foot and leg and my chest and my cough and yesterday the horse, and all they want is a work note. So, but they won't tell you unless you ask. Attempting to understand the patient's behavior as a symptom of a condition, a culture, a circumstance can again help you be objective and kind of also help you deal with your negative reactions. So if you don't try to have some strategies in place to deal with these situations, like we saw in the previous graph, it can really lead to this sense of failure and burnout. And at the very end of the chapter, they ask Ron Walls, how do you prevent burnout? And he says, you have to love your patients. They also ask one of the ER nurses that had been working with him for 20 years, and she says, you can't think of it as a career. Really, it's an education. Every day I go to work, and I learn so much about myself and humanity. So I wanted to end with a couple, a quote, and then the final paragraph in this article that I mentioned before, emergency medicine is a martial art. So how long will it take to master a martial art, or emergency medicine, or good communication, or master of your emotions? How long do you expect to live is the only respectable answer. So compassion, insight, understanding, empathy, and response, these are the accumulation of years of training dedicated to developing technical proficiency, integrity of character, and spiritual depth. Over the centuries, this has proven a very effective formula for killing people. Imagine if we were to apply this formula to healing them. So in summary, I hope you will acknowledge conflict, attempt healthy steps towards resolution, be assertive, be aware of emotions and personality types, empathize, listen to understand and get the whole story, employ effective communication, be comfortable giving and receiving feedback, be open-minded, and do something fun. That piece of grass there is where Josh and I are getting married next summer. And that's it.